Let me summarize this case like I've been doing, because some of you haven't had an opportunity to study this case. This is a relatively uncomplex case. It's the case of Mary Gardner, who is the mother of three children. We don't know their names except the third one, whose name is Sarah. The name of the children are ages 12, 11, and 6. It's apparent from at least once, not I don't know how apparent, but it's alluded to in the case that Tom and Mary have been trying to prevent further pregnancies, although she, after Sarah was born, did not attempt to have tubal ligation to prevent further pregnancies. But apparently they were using contraceptives and it's failed contraceptives. At least that's what's suggested in the case. They have a church-financed trip to Spain, and in the process of being in the time in Spain, after a week of having a good time, she becomes nauseous, is suspicious that she's pregnant, has a test done which confirms that she is pregnant with her fourth child. Her husband believes that the initial remark is that she should get an abortion. He believes that it's a theologically responsible action. After counseling many cases, something to that order. She is disturbed by his comments. We'll have a chance to comment on his comments. Is disturbed by the whole situation, is unsure what she should do. She contemplates abortion on the spot, but they agree that it's best to go back to the United States, think it over for a little while. She goes to the doctor, has it reconfirmed. Dr. Weiss then says that he'd only go through the pregnancy with her if she agrees to have a tubal ligation at the end of it. They discuss it more between them. They discuss it in front of a counselor, Carl Jenkins, in the case. He's not very important. He's just a figure or name in the case. And the case ends with the question of whether or not she should get an abortion. There is some comments that now that the children are getting older, that she has an opportunity to realize, to do other things besides being just a mother, and that, at least in Tom's eyes, this may be blocked by the appearance of the fourth child. There are questions, therefore, about Mary's role as a woman and a wife and a woman in society. I think there are three issues. Normally I drag these out, but since we only have an hour, I think the three important issues in this case are, number one, a definitional problem that bedevils all abortion debates, and I think it's important to start with it because it's a point of controversy that is terribly significant in abortion cases, but has no resolution. Terrible problem to confront in that case. Secondly, is the question of who should control the decision. And the two actors that are usually proposed for controlling the abortion decision are, one, the state, and usually when the state is promoted as a agency for controlling abortion, it means preventing abortion, that is, outlawing abortion. And the other agent is the woman herself, in consultation with whomever she may choose as for advice on the decision itself. Now, of course, there's range of opinion in between, whether it should be the state or the woman or some combination of thereof, but the two extremes are woman only, state only, and there's a combination in the spectrum between it. The third question, of course, is the personal ethical decision that Mary faces. It's in the context of the larger question. If you believe the state controls, then you shouldn't believe that Mary has any choice in the matter. If, however, you feel that the woman or some combination of the state woman is the agent for deciding, then you may well, then the question of Mary's personal choice in the matter becomes important. Of course, if Mary is a wealthy woman, no matter what the state decides, Mary can always find a way to get an abortion. That's not true necessarily of poor women, but it is of wealthy women. Before we get into a discussion of the case, I would like to cite a few facts. I wasn't preparing at Holden Village to do cases, And so I didn't bring all my notes along with my fact sheet. But I do remember a few facts about the abortion in the United States. And I would like to at least begin with some, this is sort of a potpourri of facts, unrelated facts, but I think all of which are important to the decision about abortion in the United States today. First thing to say about abortion, prior to the mid-19th century, about the mid-1800s, abortion was not a major ethical problem. It was not a major ethical problem for two reasons. One, and primary, is that abortions were unsafe. A woman put herself at considerable risk getting an abortion, far greater risk than would be the case of giving birth. The second reason is that the world did not have relatively many people. Indeed, the be fruitful and multiply counsel of Genesis, when there were perhaps a couple hundred million people on the earth versus the 5.2 million billion people on the earth today. That is to say, there was a pro-natalist philosophy, both because there was low population, and secondly, a couple had to have many children in order for a few to survive. Today, with modern technology, you do not have to have many children, and at least in wealthy societies, to have children survive, and the world is 5.2 billion population. So abortion has become a problem, and in the mid-19th century, there was a movement to restrict abortion in many countries. In the United States, by 1870, every state had a law outlawing abortion. Physicians had been one of the major groups promoting this law. Depending on your perspective, on the one hand, their stated motive was to improve the safety for women. They claimed women's welfare at their as their motive. Prior to then, of course, prior to the emergence of doctors as birthing agents, of course, birthing had been a woman's process. Midwives, from which men were largely included, and the women not only were midwives were the birthing agent, but also the ones who performed abortions, usually unsafe, but did perform abortions. And with the coming of modern medicine, the males took over the birthing process. According to some people, it was another in a long line of efforts for males to take control of women's beings, not only their bodies, but who they are. But it was at least superficially couched in the name of the welfare of women and their safety. Since then, of course, you're aware of the train of events. In 1973, a Supreme Court decision called Roe versus Wade was decided by the Supreme Court, which said that in the first trimester that the state could not interfere in the women's choice to have an abortion. In the second trimester, you understand the word trimester, the first third of the pregnancy. Second third, the state could enact a few restrictions for the safety of women, but not restrict a woman's choice. And the third trimester, as I understand, could restrict the choice of a woman to have abortion. Roe versus Wade was decided, the main argument by Justice Blackmun in the majority opinion was on the basis of privacy. Following the decision of Griswold versus the state of Connecticut on the contraceptive issue in the late 60s, which said that the state of Connecticut could not outlaw the sale of contraceptives, that what a woman and man did in their privacy was not the affairs of the state. And the same way, the issue was decided on the grounds of privacy. I don't think from a Christian ethical perspective that's a particularly compelling argument, but I think there are other ones which you may adduce. So the state of the matter is in the United States today that women basically have choice in the first two trimesters. As you have known, a more conservative majority has emerged in the Supreme Court, and with the nomination, with Thurgood Marshall leaving, and the nomination of, what's his name?
Clarence Thomas,
there's the increasing prospect that that Roe versus Wade will be overturned. Already the court has approved decisions which more and more restrict a woman's right to have an abortion. Today, in the United States, there are approximately 1.5 million abortions a year. Prior to Roe versus Wade, when abortions were illegal, it's estimated, and this is a ballpark figure because there's no way of no statistics, that approximately 600,000 abortions were performed in this country. So there's been an increase from 73 to the present, from 600,000 to 1.5 million. That number of 1.5 million is pretty well stabilized. It's no longer increasing. That amounts to, the 1.5 million amounts to about one in three pregnancies in the United States are terminated by abortion. Another 30% of pregnancies are terminated by spontaneous abortion, that is miscarriage. 6% of all abortions are teens. 74% of women getting abortions are unmarried. And 90% of abortions are performed in this country in the first trimester. I could go into the matter of contraceptive failure, which is pertinent to this case because I don't know what percentage of abortions are a result of contraceptive failure, but we do know that contraceptive failure is a significant number of cases of pregnancy. Today, abortions are safe, relatively safe. That doesn't mean that all women who have abortions do not experience complications. Medical complications are, in comparison to what was in the days of illegal abortions, are far fewer. It's relatively safe, quick, and not extremely painful, as far as I know. Having not experienced it, I'm very thin ice when I say that it doesn't involve pain. A recent study on the psychological effects by as a result of a Reagan administration team of experts said that there were very few lasting psychological effects. The claim often was made that women had lasting psychological consequences from abortion. The study done by the, I think, National Institute of Health, Koopmans, I think, was at least one of the actors in that, investigated the evidence and decided that there was, while there was evidence of some lasting psychological difficulty, it was a relatively few number of cases. On the idea of adoption, we know from studies that very few women who carry pregnancies to term are willing to give a subsequent child up to adoption. I'm not sure women here will have to tell me why that is, but I understand it's because the bonding effect that takes place between a woman and a fetus that is growing within her. The Christian tradition on abortion prior to the middle of the last century said very little. What it did say was against abortion. But the tradition is, at least from my opinion, is very sexist in its casting in women in certain roles, and in its dualisms of mind and matter, in which women are associated with the material, and their function in life is seen as exclusively with that of bearing children. Given this kind of scenario and the male domination of the tradition, it's not surprising that the tradition tends to be against abortion. In 1869, 1870 was it, the Pope declared that the moment of conception is the moment when a fetus becomes a person. Prior to that, there had been a number of different opinions, the majority opinion being that ensoulment occurred at some point later than conception. Thomas Aquinas, for example, said that ensoulment in males, and here's another example of the sexism of the tradition, ensoulment in males occurred on the 40th day and on women in the 80th day and was incomplete, he said. And thus, prior to that, there was a understanding of personhood that was that allowed for at least potentially abortion in the first 40 days, not knowing the sex of the fetus. That in 1870 that all changed, and today we have a great debate about that. That's the facts I wish to, that I can remember, and I think may be relevant. There's a lot of other facts in this case. Maybe someone else has some other piece of information they think is relevant. If not, yes.
Can you tell us about the only part of the, Bill Moyer's World of Ideas had a woman from Harvard, a blonde-headed lady, and I can't find my tape, I've been unable to watch it, who wrote a book on abortion from a European point of view, which all I remember that it was in quite contrast to that in the United States. Whereas we in the United States went by personal rights, so to speak, the state supported or maybe even influenced, I don't remember, a person having a baby, then with continuing financial support and other kinds of support as well. Do you know who I'm talking about?
Nope. There are, I have not studied the situation in Europe. This is, to be perfectly honest, this is not one of my central, one of the ethical issues that I just have good knowledge of it without being a major emphasis in my study research.
But only call it once, so.
Yeah, okay. Let me start asking the women to, like last night, I think this is a highly charged issue with a lot of emotion and feeling in it. And I'd like to shut up here, and I consider myself a male, so I will. And I would like all the males to be quiet for a few minutes. And I'd like to hear the women talk about the feelings. And I'm not sure how to approach this. By the way, I will give the men a chance, too, after the women have had a chance to ask the women to be quiet. But I want to spend a moment on the feelings level on this. And I'm wondering how Mary feels, or I might ask the question different, how would you feel if you were in a similar situation? Included in that is reactions to her husband's remarks at the outset, as well as the doctor's stipulation about caring for her in her pregnancy. So let me sit down and be quiet, and I'd like to hear the women speak. I will only utter to call on people or make maybe a side comment, but I'll be quiet for a minute. How do you feel, women? Tell us, men.
Well, I was kind of feeling that as I read the story that if I were Mary, I'd feel a little abandoned because he's kind of dumping the whole thing on me to, obviously when you're pregnant, it's a very personal thing. I mean, it's part of you right away, but she indicated right away she wanted to keep the baby, and he just said, well, it's your decision, and kind of like backed away from it like it wasn't his responsibility. And obviously, he knows she wants to keep it. I would feel abandoned if I were Mary. Mm-hmm.
But his first response was get an abortion, mm-hmm. wasn't it? And I mean, he didn't listen to her at first. He just focused on me, and that would frustrate me. I would feel, alone, abandoned is what I feel.
Your question is how do we think Mary feels?
I posed it both ways in case that you may not be able to tell how Mary would feel. How would you feel if you were in a similar situation? I'm just trying to get some of these expressions of feelings out about the question of abortion in her situation.
Excuse me, do you have any more study?
Maybe someone should hand it because I think we're out.
I believe that confusion would be my response. You know, at that point in a person's life, they do have other things that they want to move on to, and the people who are so definitely against abortion would say that was a very selfish kind of thing. But on the other hand, I'd be real confused as to whether or not I wanted to do something more for myself, or knowing that the child would be a tremendous blessing when it came. You know, that's a real confusing thing. I'd be totally confused. I think I'd have to ask for some professional help and counseling to look at it both ways.
I'm not sure if they were so, they didn't want to have children, why didn't one of them take the sterile right after the third child? Or why leave it up to contraceptives? That it kind of does leave the door open. It's not a sure door, but it's only a possibility. I mean, so it's sterilization too, but it's almost something that, I'm not sure why they didn't finalize it more a couple of kids ago, but maybe so now.
Well, it said that I read this a little earlier, so I don't remember the exact words, but said something to the effect that she just kind of kept putting it off and didn't make the final decision at the time of the delivery of the baby, Sarah, I guess was her name. And, you know, at that point, she must have not been all that definite that she didn't want to have another child. So, you know, that's a decision that can be put off to a later time. Obviously, this sneaked up on them at a time when it wasn't real convenient to make a final decision, or the decision hadn't been made by then. But for a doctor to say that he would only care for her.
Yeah, it's outrageous.
I just can't believe that. I mean, what right does he have to force her into some sort of decision, even though at that particular time it's obvious they didn't want, she may change her mind.
Going back to her point, at the birth of my second child, which was a son, I thought that would be a convenient time for me to have a tubal ligation while I was under some anesthetic. And the doctor did not want me to do that. He said, you needed to wait and to see if that child was healthy because I might want him second. If he wasn't, then I wouldn't want another one. So then time passed, as it did. And then at that point, because of the medical information the doctors had given me, saying that it was more wise at that point for the male in the family, my husband, to do that than for me because of the possible dangers of anesthetics, then that my husband should do it, not me. And that was sometimes a slow process.
In the interest of time, I'm going to shift to see if the men have something to say. There's a lot to be said about this, but unfortunately our time constraints of 1 hour, sometimes I spend 3 hours on this case actually, but let's move ahead. I wonder if the men have something to say.
Just in response to your comment, I was thinking about that same point. Why didn't they act responsibly and take care of the issue before it became an issue? And I don't know if this is a valid explanation, but what I was thinking was, well, it's like a lot of things in life. You kind of procrastinate, you get real busy, and I got to do that, and it just doesn't get done. Like, you know, you don't take those steps to prepare your house for the earthquake that may happen. You don't change the oil in your car, and there's just things that kind of get put off in the busyness of everyday life that that could explain how that didn't get done.
I'd like to respond to your fact about the findings through studies that there's not significant long-standing psychological effects. For about 15 years, I did a counseling group for incest victims, and most of the girls that were in the group hadn't become pregnant as a result of incest directly or an incestuous act, but some of the consequences to incest victims is they become promiscuous and so on, and pregnancy resulted. And a number of the young women that did become pregnant and had abortions that I had maintained contact with for a number of years experienced tremendous guilt ongoing. And I'm wondering if the studies that they've done, since they're primarily adults that get abortions, or you said something like
26% are teenagers.
Right. So maybe that, since that representative sample is much smaller, maybe it's more traumatic for teenagers. And I was thinking about why that might be, since many of them are forced into having the abortion or forced not to have an abortion. The judgment call really isn't theirs. Their families really lean on them one way or the other. And maybe it's maybe that makes it harder for them. Or maybe just the trauma going through that as a teenager is more difficult than for
I haven't read this from this study by the National Institute of Health. Has anyone read that here? I just read newspapers' accounts of it, and all I can say is that there's relatively few, far fewer than the allegations that had been made prior to the report that instigated the report in hopes, I think, of people in the Reagan administration finding substantial evidence of this, and there was not, I understand. That doesn't mean there wasn't.
Of course, incest adds a whole other dimension of complications to the...
Yes. I was just going to echo what the woman over there said, that I, in reading it, certainly felt that the husband was abandoning the wife in this particular situation, and in a sense leaving that decision, which ought to be something, you know, very deeply shared, obviously. Very confusing, but in a sense, advocating his role. One thing that I know too, in terms of male sterilization, is at least right now, one of the first questions one is asked is, how old are your children? And if you have children under two, you are, well, in a way, this is in my situation, it was quite, the question is, you know, well, the child is still quite young or whatever, and 6 years old is obviously different, but the issue of, you know, even having the wife sterilized immediately is, like this woman over here said, is a different, you know, immediately, you want to know, and the doctors are quite sensitive to that kind of issue. But I certainly think, in this case, the husband seems to be pulling back, in a sense, okay, it's your
decision. Well, I think he also contributes some element of insensitivity at the start, and certainly that's true of the doctor as well.
Yeah, oh yeah.
I was just going to say, as a professional who has supposedly counseled many people in this whole area in the past, and then he immediately on hearing it in his own situation comes across with his ideas, having absolutely no concern, it seems, for his wife's feelings and that type of thing. It seems pretty harsh and cruel treatment. He probably is quite an authoritarian type of person and has probably made most of
the... I know him, he's not. I don't think the case actually does justice to it.
Yeah, I wouldn't be too hard on Tom, no matter what his, you know, professional credentials is, that he's, his is an immediate gut reaction because it has a tremendous impact on his life, not just on his wife's. And he backed off after his initial reaction. Try to be supportive, but I wouldn't be. I mean, he made a mistake, but I wouldn't, he had sense enough to, after he thought about it, to come around. I wouldn't be too hard on him.
In fact, he could have had his way in Barcelona.
Yeah.
In his wife's little period of time there where she said, I'm going to just get this done before I get home. He could have taken those circumstances and made it happen, but he insisted otherwise, actually.
God, I never had the men talk so much.
I think the what happens, as I understand it, in stressful situations like that, is that people basically react rather than because of the time frame, because of the urgency, people tend to really struggle with first of all connecting with their feelings. And I think in reading it, I struggled. Mm-hmm. Trying to connect with my feelings, and I think men in particular tend to do that less well than women do. Mm-hmm. And also to be able to know that there's some real time constraints, and you mix that all in with the religious issues and the issues of right and wrong, it becomes you know, a heavy burden. And those kinds of of stressful situations create cracks in relationships. And so I think that it's...
Say, before I move on to the question of the personhood, wondering any responses here? Do I see a hand?
Oh, Jan. I was just going to say very briefly, I hope this isn't too facetious, but the immediate response when he said, well, I want to leave this up to you, is one of abandonment. However, if he had made his case very clear of what I want, then I think the reaction would have been, interfering woman's rights, kind of thing. No, I would react that way, but I would have been surprised if we hadn't gotten some of that reaction. So I wondered if he could be, if there was any way he could be right.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on. The question of personhood is a bedeviling question in this debate, and this is one of the interesting features of this debate because it's a central question that is terribly problematic. In the continuum from conception to birth, the question is where in that process are we to consider the fetus a person to be protected, the technical term would be a constitutional person, a person to be protected by the laws of the state. That's one way of putting it. A more theological way is, when does the fetus become a person? Now, what are the possibilities? There's a whole range of possibilities. Some would say, at...
I was just reading in the Bible the other day, and from a Christian's point of view, and I understand this man is a pastor, that, and say, for example, in the book of Jeremiah, God says to Jeremiah, well, I knew you before you even formed in the belly, and I'd already made plans for your life. So even before he was conceived in that case, his life was already planned out by God. And then I read in the Psalms where David was talking about being fearfully and wonderfully made, and how even in the deep parts of his mother's belly that God had already known him. And then I think, which may support for later, but when Mary went to see Elizabeth, Elizabeth says, you know, when my grave heard your salutation, he leaped in my womb. But it says, not only he leaped in my womb, but Mary said, Elizabeth says, he leaped in my womb for joy. Now, how she knew why the babe leaped, if you say are a believer of the Bible, it says, the babe in my womb leaped for joy when he heard your voice. So it would indicate to me, from a Christian's point of view, that life begins at conception.
At conception. In fact, according to your perspective, it may begin before conception.
That's true.
Because you say God ordains every... I assume that your one of the conclusions would be that God ordains each pregnancy.
Well, I don't know about that. I'm just saying God knows before Jeremiah. I called you before you were...
Well, if everybody qualifies for that, then we'd assume that God is responsible for each pregnancy, is that right?
I think he is involved in the pregnancy. I don't think he causes the pregnancy. To say that God is responsible is like, well, since you're not married, God meant for you to have this baby because he knows all life. And I think that would be an erroneous
But it's part of God's plan for each woman is so many children, is that right?
No, it's a lie. I think that God's plan is for some women not to have children or husbands at all. It's society that messes it up and says you got to have both.
All right. I'm just trying to figure out the Bible verses that she brings out here in support of her argument is ones that are frequently encountered to suggest that the moment of conception, or even before, is the moment of personhood, and thus the state should control, since that's a person, that means that any abortion is murder.
I believe that.
I can understand from a legal point of view why it would be necessary and important to make some decision on this, and I bet you it comes down to a fairly arbitrary decision, whether it's 20 weeks or 15 or 25 or whatever. But it seems to me that a lot of the struggle that people have with this issue makes this definition beside the point, because the people are struggling to decide whether they will snuff out a life that will become a baby and a child and unfold and have all the glories and struggles and the wonders of being alive. And that decision to snuff out is just as relevant at time 1 second after conception as it is at 20 weeks in pregnancy.
It's clearly, it's true that at the moment of conception, a genetic code is implanted. The question always has been raised is that however, personhood is certainly potential personhood, beginning personhood. It's not a genetic code for a bear or a mouse, but for a human being. But the question always arises, is the genetic code all that we are as human beings? And the further problem is that the implantation of a genetic code is a biological event, whereas the question about personhood is a theological or philosophical definition. And you just can't immediately jump from a biological beginning of the implantation of a code to a philosophical, theological understanding of personhood. So conception is one of the options. Other options say that while that's a beginning person, that personhood is developmental, that a fetus continues through the process of gestation to become a person. An arbitrary moment is decided upon. A lot of people say viability or sometime around that. There's nothing sacred about that as a definition either. Some people say quickening when the nervous system is present. There's a various number of kinds of moments. I just want to point that out. But again, I think the big problem here is the definitional one. How do you move from the biological implantation of a genetic code to a philosophical or theological understanding of personhood? Because personhood can have a whole number of different definitions. Consequently, definitions, by the way, can't be proven. They're assumptions. And thus you cannot refute the definition or an assumption. You can say you don't agree with it, you can't refute it. So different people have different points on the spectrum where they would claim legitimacy for their assumptions, or at least that their assumptions has as much grounding as somebody else's.
I also think we're seeing two different issues when we talk about theological perspective of each individual and the law of the state. What my theological beliefs about abortion and what I get from scripture are for me, and I don't want the state telling me what to do with my body. Making my decisions, my moral decisions, counting in that respect. So I really think that they're separate from each other.
One of the arguments that one encounters is that by if the state accepts that the moment of conception is the moment of personhood, which has been in the right to life position, what the state in fact is doing is imposing a religious perspective, and so it becomes a church-state issue in some people's minds. Yes?
I'm not sure that's necessarily true. But
I said that's one of the arguments.
Okay. I will say that I... looking at the case study, I don't think that this is a particularly difficult case study. There could have been much more difficult scenarios drawn out.
Yeah, well, that's why I drew it, because I didn't want to have a teenage girl who had been raped by her father or something like that, which is a bizarre case.
Yeah, you know, the questions of convenience or population control that you use, you know, I think are not as difficult as some other decisions that could be made. But the question you're answering now is the critical question. And nothing else, you know, this is by far the critical question. And it seems to me in reading this, first of all, I'm surprised by Tom's insensitivity. And I'm upset with his insensitivity in this case. But I think Mary kind of answers the question herself when she talks about going to the counseling situation. And she says she's always known the difference between right and wrong. And she insinuates that this is wrong, the abortion being wrong, and that she couldn't share it with anybody because it was wrong, whether it be her children or her friends or whoever else. I think basically Mary is answering the question herself in the last part of the...
Yeah, that's the third question. I'm wondering if...
Well, I think she's answering it for... Well, she's answering it for me anyway. I don't know if...
How does that relate then to the first question, which we're asking now?
What she's saying is that the fetus becomes life at conception.
And you think that's her
perspective? That's what she's saying to me. She's saying she knows the difference between right and wrong.
Okay. Yeah?
Well, I agree that there's a genetic code that, you know, it's human life. And by the time that you're aware you're pregnant,
or by the time I was aware I was pregnant, I was very interested in a developing child, and I always thought of it as a child because I wanted to, and I followed the development very closely. But I have a hard time thinking of a blastocyst as a human, you know, as a person. And I guess I'm fairly comfortable with distinctions about viability. I'm not really pro-abortion, but I have enough sense that there are times when abortion probably is the best of bad choices, and if it's to be done, the earlier the better, and certainly not as one a fetus approaches viability.
It is interesting that we do not perform, at least not normally, perform funerals when a fetus is aborted or spontaneously aborted. And as long as I'm on the motion of, on the notion of spontaneous abortion, I'm wondering if, you know, some people would assert that each pregnancy is God's will or God's doing or God ordained it or is part of a plan. I'm wondering if what we then do in that perspective to how we conceive of spontaneous abortion, which occurs. Is that the result of God's act too? That's an interesting kind of problem.
I just wanted to say what Alan just said, which was if we're talking about killing, or use the language of killing, then he says we're talking about life.
I'd like to say that I don't know now, about 15 years ago, I knew a lady that had a miscarriage. She wasn't trying to have one, as far as I know. But the baby was 5 months old, and she was required to have a funeral for that, because she was 5 months pregnant.
I said, it's normally not performed. I mean, what I'm trying to point to is that normally we make a distinction between a two-week-old fetus and a live child. And that's an interesting distinction that we do make in fact, even though we may say that the fetus is fully a person and should be protected by the state.
As I've struggled with this myself, I've often thought of the case of a relative of mine who had a child. The birth was induced because of the threat to her life, and it was at a point of possible viability. And so they were really hoping, they held on to it as long as possible, and then when her life was really threatened, they tried to take the child and hoped it would live. And it did live. But if it had not, that would have been an abortion. And, you know, lots of money was spent in keeping this child in ICU and helping her to live. And she's a blessing to the family, and they certainly wanted that child. But I always think, if she hadn't lived, she would have been an abortion. And then what would everybody have thought about it?
That's on the boundary line of all kinds of different, what to call the situation. That's a close one.
I just want to throw in another issue in relation to personhood, and this, in a sense, may be raised by the Jeremiah passage, that it's really tricky theologically, but perhaps part of the issue of personhood might be one that involves a choice. That is, what is it that makes Jeremiah Jeremiah? It's that God has chosen this. What is it that makes us human? Whatever. We talked about this the other day in talking about, what was it, souls or something like this?
I have soul.
Is that, in the biblical tradition, is that God has chosen this particular creature for some kind of unique relationship. And perhaps, it could be really screwy, I know, but I mean, it's something that I thought a lot about. Perhaps part of the issue of personhood is the willing that this be a person, or that a willing to have a relationship with this, this embryo growing inside, and perhaps that is part of what is that makes a person a person.
Some people think that the unique characteristic of personhood is relationality.
Right, that's what I'm getting.
And would then say that a fetus in the early stages of development doesn't have that capacity, and thus the person who develops when that capacity is a possibility, which is at some time a viability. I point that as one of the arguments.
Yeah, all of those are arbitrary.
Right.
They're not arbitrary, but they are, there's none that can be established.
Right, exactly.
So whatever you answer to the first question is an arbitrary statement, and an arbitrary decision that you make as to when a fetus becomes a person, and you then whatever decision you make, then you bring forth your forces of theological and philosophical arguments to support that.
Right.
And that's why you never settle that argument.
That's right. You'll never settle this argument, because no position can be established with any degree of finality that absolutely sets the other position in a contradictory or unviable position. All positions have some viability. I think some are worse than others.
I mean, we can, what the woman over there said, we can turn that on its head. And what you said over here about relationship, we can turn that on its head. I mean, in just a continuing circle.
Justice Blackmun said that since, in the majority opinion, in the Roe versus Wade, that since philosophers and theologians haven't been able to solve this problem, far be it from justices to even attempt that. So they decided on the right of privacy and not on the question of personhood. But I think for Christians for whom personhood is a very important concept theologically, that we've got to wrestle with this one, even though we've come to the conclusion that there's not one that can be established with finality, wrestling with that problem in our own consciences, it seems to me to be very important.
Well, also goes to that point you had yesterday about our belief system is how God works in the world. If we believe God knows all, fine, new Jeremiah, the new David, but it doesn't mean necessarily that he chooses to interfere or do this or do that.
But also the question is, how do you interpret those texts? Ruby has interpreted it one way. There are all alternative ways of interpreting that those texts.
I mean, I'm sure maybe Saddam Hussein thinks he was chosen by Allah or God to lead his people. And he might write that God chose me before I was born. He might write the same thing.
Yeah.
Are you saying that from a Christian context we have an ethical dilemma, only that we don't have an ethical dilemma if all we're doing is interrupting the growth of a bit of tissue that's not yet a person? That we come to have the ethical dilemma about what's the right thing to do only after the tissue has somehow been transformed into a person?
I think that there's still an ethical dilemma whether or not you, how you conclude that. I would say that a fetus, my personal perspective is that a fetus is good. It's part of the created order, which God created good. Now the question is, the debate is, how to measure it against the well-being of a woman. I say well-being, not freedom, but well-being of a woman. There are circumstances, in other words. And the perspective that I would hold, and some others would hold, is that the fetus is good at conception. It becomes increasingly more a person as the period of time goes on, and there does appear to be a time, there is a time when the value of the fetus is more than or equal to the well-being of the woman. But in the early stages of pregnancy, there may be an understanding that the well-being of the woman considerations, which is the one part of the dilemma, outweigh the personhood of the fetus in that stage of development. You see what I'm saying?
I do see what you're saying.
That's basically, I think, I don't know of any Christians, except some very extreme people who say the fetus is tissue, that don't agree that the fetus at the moment of conception is a potential human being and has value. Even the strongest rights people would, I think, in most cases, almost all cases, affirm that. But you see, the debate is whether which value, the well-being of the woman or the well-being of the fetus, should rule in a given circumstance. that's where the debate lies. And this is important, where does the value of the fetus out overrule the well-being of the woman? And then the question further on is the life of the woman. I think, I don't know, hardly anyone who now says that the fetus has more importance than the life of the woman. There may be some few people, some women who may elect to sacrifice their lives for their baby in the case of a situation where both lives are at stake. But I don't know of anyone who would say that a fetus has more value than a real live woman. I certainly wouldn't make that statement. Let's move on to the question of who should control the decision. I hope you recognize that now that we've got an imponderable dilemma when the person should become a that is, a constitutional person. Now, if you, the so-called right to life position, by the way, I don't like these terms, right to life and pro-choice. I'm going to use them because they're common nomenclature. They are polemical positions, that is, they're argumentative positions. When you call yourself right to life, you're saying that the other people are pro-death. And when you say you're pro-choice, you mean to say the other people are anti-freedom. All these are polemical. Recognizing those limitations, let me use those terms. I don't know of any better to signal the two positions. Let's see what you say. Let's just for a moment say, try to understand what the right to life position is. It's, by the way, of the two positions, I think it's the simpler of the two to state and come to a conclusion about. How would you state the right to life perspective on who should control the abortion decision?
State.
What?
The state.
Well, give me a line of reasoning there.
Well, what the right to life, as I understand it, I've read it, what it says that fetus has the same constitutional rights as does any other person. And, therefore, they have the right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. And so, therefore, they should be protected by the same constitutional guarantees that the rest of us are.
And the abortion is?
Is an abortion, therefore, is murder.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Or
that's the heart of the right to life argument. There's a whole number of other arguments that one hears in these discussions. From a Roman Catholic perspective, and some Protestants, one would hear a natural law perspective, which would suggest that. And the same argument in Roman Catholic thought goes for contraception, and the natural law perspective goes something like that in the creation God has ordained a certain purpose for certain activities. The purpose of sexuality is the procreation of children. In later days, it's also the love, mutual love of two people. The third assumption is that we are reasonable human beings and through the use of reason can look at the creation and discover those purposes. If we look at creation, we see the purpose of sexuality is procreation. It's also the will of God in the creation. And therefore, anything that interrupts that procreation is against the will of God. Hence, contraception and abortion, which is the last resort form of contraception, are both against God's will. That's the line of reasoning there. You have got this pained look on your face. May I ask you to share your pain?
I'm not sure I can say this one. This may be a counterpoint. But I might personally could agree with that statement if I weren't being living in a society that is so structured and so controlled by the policies of the government that have a great economic impact on this. And they do. I mean, there's all sorts of things, the Federal Reserve Board, a whole bunch of things that have a terrific impact on me and my family. And it, to me, it's like one's way over here and one's way over there, that the state has a terrific impact on how we live increasingly so for the last 40 or 50 years. And if the state also says that you have to have another child, you cannot have abortion, but we don't have to do anything to help you, then we're out of... You're forcing me not to be able to live in the structure very well that they have told me I have to live in. The can of worms is, then, how would we deal with that?
you know, who would say who's sustainable living and that kind of thing.
On the other side, on the well-being of women argument is that the state does not provide very adequately that then to say the woman should have an abortion was to consign a woman and her child in some cases to very dehumanizing circumstances. Some people on that side say we shouldn't be worried so much about abortion, but providing the conditions in which women and men presumably can bring children into the world and a safe and secure and a life of basic necessities, which we're not doing according to that perspective.
And we're taking, to me, like you're saying, we're taking this issue out of context as well.
Now this is more the pro-choice side of the argument. You see, you're making an argument on the well-being of women, I think.
And the family.
And the family, yes.
I think if the state has the power to deny abortion, then the state also has the power to force abortion. If the state has that power, it can go either way in different circumstances and different errors.
Do you all understand that argument? That the right to prevent abortion is this, you implicitly agree that the state has the right to force abortion, if it so wills. It has control of the decision.
It seems to me like we're saying that pregnancy is something you get from drinking the water, and that because I didn't have any choice in this matter, then I can determine how the outcome. It isn't like you have to be pregnant. And so then to say, I have this right or I don't have this right, based on something that I could control 100% before I become pregnant, except in the cases of incest and rape, which, if we are honest, most of us, the people we know, the pregnancies are not caused by incest and rape. I mean, some are, and that's a whole other story, but probably, I could safely say 95% of the pregnancies are not caused by incest.
How about failed contraceptives? Would you put that in the same category?
I don't believe in contraceptives.
Okay. Well, if the state can decide these things, can force abortions or force not abortions, how have we then decided to force the illegality of drunk driving? Now, we don't seem to argue about the...
We don't also, more pertinently, we don't say that murderers should go free. We put murderers in jail and deny them their freedom. Is that what you're sort of means, what you're saying?
Well, we've made a decision that drunk driving is wrong.
Right. And we put drunk drivers away.
How do we decide that? We can't decide that abortion is wrong, but we can decide that drunk driving is wrong and child molestation is wrong.
By majority vote of the legislature and the concurrence of the court system is how we decide those things. I can tell you that much.
Bonner, I think what he's trying to say, though, is that just in regard to the comment about if we can, as people, as society, prevent abortions, then we can also enhance them or promote them. Do you do the same thing with drunk driving or child abuse? We can prevent child abuse. Does that mean, as a state, we can also enhance it? We can also.
Good.
Well, okay.
You could enact such laws. I would not.
I would not think that would be a responsible position to take as a society, though.
Well, I think that the analogy is more pertinent than that, in that there are some countries who have, for example, China, that have been promoting a very active abortion policy. It's not forced abortion, but when you all of a sudden say the state has that right to interfere in a woman's decision, then it can go both ways. And China has elected at least close to the other way.
Well, these laws, like on drunk driving, laws are passed because it's been demonstrated that that kind of activity does great harm, not only to individuals, but to society as a whole. People who would drive a vehicle while intoxicated, it's been demonstrated to do great harm. And so to prevent that, why we...
Well, but the argument that you know easily that by a right to life person, that the abortion does great harm to the fetus.
That's right. And that's why the question gets back to that. Is what great harm is it that is done by legalized abortion? What great harm is done?
Well, if you think that life is sacred, which is...
I know.
Something that people say, then harm is done. unless there are, I mean, we, in the Christian tradition, also allow for killing in warfare. We say that some circumstances are worse than killing, which is the suffering of outrageous injustice or something like that. And so it's very interesting that in the case of warfare, in many mainline traditions allow for a justifiable war. Some people would claim the same thing holds for pregnancy, which is a justifiable abortion.
Well, for example, it used to be it was illegal to charge interest for money that was loaned, and it was called usury. And the reason that they quit doing it is because they found out that it did a great deal of good to loan money and charge interest. But there is a point when you charge so much interest where it does great harm. So the whole process of charging interest is managed, and there are limits on it.
This is an interesting, usury was considered natural law, as is proscriptions against abortion and contraceptives in the Roman Catholic Church.
Right.
And what you're pointing to is one of the